Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
This is Richard. So here we are. It's Thursday, 2 p.m. Before we continue, let me just please give you some housekeeping information, courtesy of Ryan, the engineer. Some of you have been having trouble with the podcast. There was an old podcast which apparently has got stuck on the system and didn't go away, but there is, in fact, a new one, and in order to access it, you would want to go to the iTunes store and put in Richard Martin, and up will pop Richard Martin's wake-up call. The one you're looking for is the one with my picture attached, okay? So what had happened is the URL was switched, so you have to resubmit to iTunes. But that should work fine. It really shouldn't be a problem. And so please just go ahead and do that. All right. A quick word on the market here. We've been seeing some, quite aggressive volatility on the up and down side in the market these last few days. This is always a sign of the top. We've been seeing sort of intervention in the last few minutes to sort of push it up. And bonds, as I'm sure you may be aware, have been collapsing, which means, of course, that interest rates have been surging. Long-term rates in particular have been going up very hard. And, of course, as you will understand, that poses grave problems for real estate because mortgages in turn have been jumping in terms of the interest payable. And that is affixed to the 10-year rate. And along with the rising mortgage rates, we've been seeing a drop in applications for mortgages. There's been out-of-control spending by the Fed and the Treasury. The consumer, as I'm sure you are aware, is in terrible shape right now. Unemployment is increasing. People, of course, cannot refinance mortgages. There is a complete freeze in the mortgage market right now, which is much worse than last autumn. There's been a sharp jump in energy costs. Gasoline is back to the same kind of problem we saw last year, with out-of-control rises and in the price of oil, although they say that there's plenty of oil sitting around on ships in the ocean, wondering what to do with themselves. There's been interventions and intrusions and micromanaging of salaries and compensation, and basically this is a critical time for every aspect of the economy and the financial world. So there you have it, not a pretty picture, and one which I am quite certain the stock market is about to acknowledge in a very sickening way indeed. So hold on to the sides of whatever vehicle you're traveling in for a very, very rocky ride. Again, my warning to you all is get out of the stock market. Do not hold anything in funds, unit trusts, stock futures on the long side. Whatever it may be that people tell you are not stocks, if they have the word stock in it, I assure you they are. So don't let people fool you and give you all kinds of stories about how the stock market is not concerned with funds and ETFs and things, because the whole thing is all bound up and you will suffer a nasty fate if you involve yourself in them. Right. Well, now I came across an interesting article about how humans prefer cockiness to expertise, which probably goes to explain why the most nerdy among the economists don't probably get much of a look in. And in particular, I think of Nouriel Roubini, who was a fusty old professor in NYU, I think it was, or maybe Columbia. I never remember which university he works in. With absolutely no exposure to the outside world, suddenly overnight the man becomes a economic star. And, well, you know, economists are not known for their overt gestures of exaggerated flamboyance, but Roubini has amply filled the gap. He has traveled all over the world, got paid large sums of money for pontificating, and now, because he appears to exhibit this cockiness and assurance, seems to have culled for himself quite a considerable following. So anyway, just to let you know a little bit about what they say here, they ask if you've ever wondered why the pundits who fail to predict the current economic crisis are still being paid for their opinions. And the answer is that it's a consequence of the way human psychology works in a free market, and that's according to a study of how people's self-confidence affects the way others respond to their advice. The research by Dodd Moore of Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, shows that we prefer advice from a confident source, even to the point that we are willing to forgive a poor track record. Moore argues that in competitive situations, this can drive those offering advice to increasingly exaggerate how sure they are. And it spells bad news for scientists who try to be honest about gaps in their knowledge. You may remember how John McCain, during the election run-up, admitted that he didn't know much about economics. Well, he got lambasted for that. It was an honest comment, but sometimes apparently honesty doesn't pay. So the important thing is to be glamorous and to be strong in your opinions, and apparently you will overcome all the odds. In Moore's experiment, I continue here, in Moore's experiment, volunteers were given cash for correctly guessing the weight of people from their photographs. In each of the 8 rounds of the study, the guessers bought advice from one of the 4 other volunteers. Sorry, lost my place. I was doing something else. The guessers could see in advance how confident each of these advisors was, but not which weights they had opted for. From the start, the more confident advisors found more buyers for their advice, and this caused the advisors to give answers that were more and more precise as the game progressed. This escalation in precision disappeared when guessers simply had to choose whether or not to buy the advice of a single advisor. In the later rounds, guessers tended to avoid advisors who had been wrong previously, but this effect was more than outweighed by the bias towards confidence. The findings add weight to the idea that if offering expert opinion is your stock in trade, it pays to appear confident. Describing his work at an Association for Psychological Science meeting in San Francisco last month, Moore said that following the advice of the most confident person often makes sense, as there is evidence that precision and expertise do tend to go hand in hand. For example, people give a narrower range of answers when asked about subjects with which they are more familiar. There are times, however, when this link breaks down. With complex but politicized subjects, such as global warming, for example, scientific experts who stress uncertainties lose out to activists or lobbyists with a more emphatic message. So if honest advice risks being ignored, what is a responsible scientific advisor to do? It's an excellent question, says Moore, and I'm not sure that I have a great answer. Well, of course, the persona that springs up out of all this is Jim Cramer, who is as flamboyant as any market maven has ever been, probably in history. Although I do remember Joe Granville, the famed technician, coming into rooms and throwing balloons up in the air and playing the piano and singing the bag holder's blues, but I guess that's a subject for another time. So just beware, ladies and gentlemen, the fact that somebody is forthright in their opinions doesn't necessarily mean they are righter than the next man. There you go, some advice. All right, so now the next thing I want to do, courtesy of Rona, is to mention an article by Arthur Laffer, the famous economist who drew his Laffer curve, that I won't bore you with right now, but he wrote an article entitled Get Ready for Inflation and Higher Interest Rates. Now, this is another in my series of how to tell when you're being fed nonsense and what to do when it happens. Now, you will recall that in the late 70s, the federal chairman of the time, Paul Volcker, sort of saved the world from inflation by brutally raising interest rates so high that he kind of throttled off inflation and brought the system back down. There are grounds for supposing that that was not exactly what did cause inflation to subside, but never mind, that's what he did, and clearly if interest rates are higher and money is more expensive, then it's going to be harder to access, and therefore people are likely to spend less, and therefore inflation is likely to be less. However, this article by Laffer is entitled Get Ready for Inflation and Higher Interest Rates. Now, all things being equal, if you read that, you should say to yourself, uh-oh, something's off here. Why is he talking about inflation and higher interest rates in the same breath? So we keep an open mind, do we not? And we read the article. Now, I'm only going to read a couple of excerpts from the article. I'm not going to give you the whole thing because it's really, trust me, it's irrelevant. But I do think that I'm going to ask you also to believe me when I say that when I claim that some comments that he makes are unsupported by evidence or other material that can justify what he says, it is true. That you must trust me, believe me, because it's absolutely true. And so he comes in and says in the second paragraph, here we stand more than a year into a grave economic crisis with a projected budget deficit of 13% of GDP. That's more than twice the size of the next deficit since World War the next largest deficit since World War II. Okay? He carries on. The unfunded liabilities of federal programs are over the 100 trillion mark. Such a debt all but guarantees high interest rates, massive tax increases, and partial default on government promises. Well, so far, so good. These are pretty factual and logical conclusions. He makes a statement, he makes a logical conclusion, and it seems to make sense. And I don't have a problem with it. But then he continues, but as bad as the fiscal picture is, panic-driven monetary policies portend to have even more dire consequences. We can expect rapidly rising prices at much, much higher interest rates over the next 4 or 5 years, and a concomitant deleterious impact on output and employment not unlike the late 1970s. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's, if he was only to justify that comment, and he was would flesh it out and tell us why he makes these otherwise outlandish comments, I would be only too pleased. But if he doesn't, there is absolutely no explanation for those comments. We can expect rising prices, rapidly rising prices. Why? There's no answer. There's no explanation. I mean, if I tell you that prices are going to go up next year, surely you want to know why I think that. It's not enough for me just to make a statement. You want to know the justification for that statement, if only because you're curious. But beneath that, if it means that you want to understand the logical thinking behind why prices should rise. I mean, it's a natural instinct to want to have an inquisitive mind. But there's no explanation for this. And he says much higher interest rates over the next 4 or 5 years. Why? Why would interest rates go up if the consumer has no money to spend? if housing prices are collapsing, how can you see interest rates rise other than on a very short-term basis like you're seeing right now with the dollar basically moving down along with bond prices, which are being sold clearly because people are trying to get out of the dollar? There's no logical explanation why on a long-term basis interest rates should rise. Interest rates rise, ladies and gentlemen, because people are competing for money. Here, you're just seeing a simple panic out of bonds. Then he says, he talks about a concomitant deleterious impact on output and employment, not unlike the late 1970s. Well, I guess he's saying there, unemployment will fall. Well, yes, it will fall. But that's nothing to do with higher interest rates and inflation. I don't see where the inflation comes in there. Let me read you another excerpt. Reduced demand for money combined with rapid growth in money is a surefire recipe for inflation and higher interest rates. Why? I mean, that makes no sense. Do we get an explanation as to that comment? Do we get some kind of fleshed out continuation of the idea? No. The next thing he says is the higher interest rates themselves will also further reduce the demand for money, thereby exacerbating inflationary pressures. Well, if there's a reduced demand for money, surely that is deflationary, isn't it? Why would it be inflationary, thereby exacerbating inflationary pressures? Again, no explanation. The very next sentence is, it's difficult to estimate the magnitude of the inflationary and interest rate consequences of the Fed's actions because, frankly, we haven't ever seen anything like this in the U.S. Well, that's true, and it is difficult. And therefore, if it's difficult, how can you be so sure that there will be massive inflation and interest rate rises? And now you're just saying it's difficult to estimate the magnitude of the consequences. I agree with you. We're treading in uncharted water here. And then finally, to date, what's happened is potentially far more inflationary than were the monetary policies of the 1970s. Again, no explanation. So, you know, you're left hanging with these what are otherwise completely absurd comments. And I had a conversation with Rona, who kindly sent me this. I had an email exchange with her. And I think we both came to the conclusion that, none of this made any sense. But I just wanted to draw this to your attention, ladies and gentlemen, because I want you to be aware that when you read something that doesn't seem to make sense, the chances are very, very high that it really doesn't. And so just watch out and be careful. Okay? All right, let's take... I just received an email. We're going to do some emails here because we've got a lot of them, so I think we'd better get right to it. First email just came in a few minutes ago. There's a person called Tom who wrote in saying, enjoy your show and like that you encourage questions, so here goes. Around a month ago, I bought TBT at 50, and it's done just fine since. I have noticed two apparent influences on TBT. Now, TBT is double the inverse of the bond price. Okay, so when the bond prices, when U.S. government longer 10-year bond prices go down, the stock TBT goes up. Okay, so one, this is what he says. TBT goes up as bonds drop due to interest rate increases. Correct. Two, TBT tends to follow the stock market, which is in agreement with the traditional trend that when stocks go up, bonds tend to go down. So TBT then would trend upward as it is a bond inverse. Well, I'll just finish the email and we'll discuss that. Recently, you've been warning about a devastating decline in the stock market. So my question is, how do you see TBT behaving during an imminent stock market decline? I'm thinking about buying more TBT on a dip, but wonder if I am too late. Thanks, Tom. As you point out, Tom, when the stock market falls, generally speaking, bond prices go up. But we've seen such a big move down in bond prices that I wouldn't be surprised to see a few weeks where stocks and bonds go in the same direction. So be very careful of any idea that the automatic move is inverse to the stock market in bonds, Tom. And so I wouldn't buy any more TBT at this point, but don't sell what you have. because you might get some more juice out of that one. So be careful with the perceived moves of one market against another. Very often they seem to work, but the reality is that they may fool you for a limited space of time. So never depend on those parities, because many people have in the past got very hurt doing that. So word to the wise, Tom. Thank you for your call, or rather your email. All right. I get an email at 1:37 a.m. this morning from Mirek Petrovic. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce your name, but I will read your email. Dear Richard, as you are leaving, me and my family have decided to seek permanent residency either in Canada or New Zealand. Not an easy task. And by no small measure, thanks to you and the info you put into perspective for your listeners. The feeling is like being on the sixth deck below on Titanic and frantically trying to get out to the life raft. It wasn't an easy decision for a family with four children to decide to move after 14 years in the US, but I think we owe it to our kids. The prospect of starting over from scratch became less terrifying than the prospect of staying here. Growing up in communism, me in Czechoslovakia and my wife in the USSR, left us with memories of how life is when government controls everything. And government will be stepping into our lives more and more. Once was enough. Telling our friends of how we see the current situation leads nowhere. Everyone just thinks we're crazy, and all we get is, well, it's bad everywhere right now. So we just shut up. We are leaving to have a peace of mind. Thank you, and enjoy your new life in Singapore, Mirek. Well, Mirek, you are indeed very brave. But I fear that you will be laughing last, and therefore laughing loudest, because what I'm seeing coming down the pike here in the United States is indeed very, very frightening. And I did quite a nice piece of that in one of the shows that you will be able to listen to in July and August, ladies and gentlemen, talking just indeed about the fascist nature of what's going on. It's a very... I was going to say powerful, but probably that's not the word I'm looking for. It's a very strongly worded show, and I hope you will forgive me if you feel that I'm overdoing it, but I do not see any way to overestimate the fear that I have of what's happening, especially with Obama, who seems to be taking the wheels of the economy in his hands and driving the thing over a cliff with his dictatorial gambits about how much compensation CEOs and other executives should receive, what should happen to Chrysler, what should happen to General Motors, who should receive how much compensation in the bankruptcy. I mean, what happened to the free market, ladies and gentlemen? You may think that he's doing the right thing, and I'm not going to argue with you, but at the same time, I need to understand what this country thinks it's doing if it subscribes to the free market ethic and it allows these politicians to run riot over the economy. If this is an experiment, all I can say is it had better work. Well, anyway, thank you for the email, Mirek. Very kind of you. Let me see what else I had. Okay, Anonymous. Now, look, you, Anonymous, put your Anonymous at the bottom, and you did put it in the subject line, but I almost missed it. And so please, please be careful. Your email is entitled, "What Forces Are Driving the Bear Market Rally?" Hello, Richard. With the recent 3-month rally, which you predicted, and most economists are calling this a bear market rally, and fundamentals are weak, what forces are driving this rally? Furthermore, what do you think will end it? Thank you, Anonymous. Well, basically, first of all, bear market rallies are the most frightening phenomena that you can find anywhere in the stock market cycle, because by their very nature, they are terminal. And they bring more people to their knees than any other form of movement in the market that I know. And the reason for that is that people at the beginning of a rally are very skeptical, as they were in March, And then as the thing progresses, they become more and more competent, and then the powers that be in the form of the Wall Street analysts, the economists, and people like Paul Krugman that we're going to talk about in a moment, become completely crazed and turn around and tell you that everything is going to be okay. The most famous, of course, example of this being Irving Fisher in April of 1930, who declared that we were on a permanent plateau of prosperity, not to worry, everything was going to be okay. And then a few days later, the market turned around after just exactly the same kind of rally that we have seen in the last 3 months, turned around and lost 89% of its value in the next 2.5 years. And poor old Irving Fisher was left high and dry, the most famous, the most prestigious economist of all time up to that point. Absolutely and utterly, totally wrong. And we're going to see this again and again, and the people coming out of the woodwork giving you these frenetic explanations about why everything's going to be okay, and I'm afraid they are going to have the proverbial egg on their faces in short order. To answer your question, what forces are driving this rally? Well, that's one of them. Another force, of course, is institutions that cannot afford to be left out of a rally like this, because if the market continues to go and they are underinvested, then the fund managers risk losing their jobs, and that's going to be no joke. So they're in pushing, you know, other people's money, or OPM, into the market, and they, of course, will end up with egg on their faces too. So that's another thing. And, of course, you know, when you get to the end of a quarter, or in this particular case, the end of a half year, it becomes quite critical to be sure that you are correctly placed for the investors and your bosses and managers who are looking at your portfolios to make sure that you're following the market. So that's kind of another area. You have the speculators also who are pushing up the futures markets, most notably overnight. They have a positive effect on the market. The list just goes on and on. There are lots and lots of people driving the rally. What will end it, Anonymous, is really interesting, because the end of rallies in general come with no reason attached, absolutely no reason attached, which means that when the market falls, the pundits who write articles in newspapers for the following day, and those who go on television the same night, are left scratching their heads wondering why the market fell 350 points in one day. And there is, of course, no explanation. So that's usually what ends it. In other words, it's so difficult to define that you really cannot blow the whistle or ring the bell, whatever the cliche is, to describe the end of a bear market rally. You just have to go with the flow. And in my opinion, that means taking your positions and waiting patiently for the market to do what it has to do, according to your theory. All right, Anonymous, thank you very much for that. Now we come to John Carr's email, which I thought was very interesting, and in fact so interesting that I did a lot of research on it. So it's going to take me a few minutes to answer your email, actually, John. And the email was, Richard, this was passed on to me. Would you care to comment? And it was an article entitled, Nobel winner Krugman sees U.S. recession ending soon. Okay? He did say the U.S. economy probably will emerge from the recession by September. And I quote, I would not be surprised if the official end of the U.S. recession ends up being, in retrospect, dated sometime this summer, said in a lecture today at the London School of Economics. Things seem to be getting worse more slowly. There's some reason to think that we're stabilizing. Krugman, who, as you may know, writes for the New York Times, he's a Princeton University economist, has warned recently that the U.S. government hasn't done enough to help the country's economy recover. Last month at a conference in Abu Dhabi, he said the fiscal stimulus is, quote, only enough to mitigate the slump, not induce recovery. Even with a recovery, quote, almost surely unemployment will keep rising for a long time, and there's a lot of reason to think that the world economy is going to stay depressed for an extended period, Krugman said. The U.S. Federal Reserve's efforts to stabilize the markets Measures that have swelled the central bank's balance sheet have helped, he said. A lot of the spreads in the markets have come down, and the acute financial stuff seems to have come to a halt. So that's pretty much it. Now, again, as I said in an earlier email, here you have a man who basically says that he thinks that the U.S. recession will end up dated sometime this summer. Absolutely no reason given. There is no explanation. I mean, usually, when I say to you, ladies and gentlemen, you've got to pass these comments carefully, because you have to try to see where the illogic lies in the argument. It seems to me just as likely that you won't have anything to pass. You'll have these statements thrown out there with no explanation and no corresponding comment. And the only thing that I can think of is that these people are so arrogant that they just think that they can say whatever they like, and everybody will just believe them because, you know, here's this Nobel Prize-winning economist. Well, sorry, but the track record of the Nobel jury isn't that illustrious, quite frankly. And so I wouldn't let that turn my head. But Paul Krugman obviously believes he's now up on a pedestal, and he can just issue, these decrees from on high, and people have just got to accept them because he is Krugman, Paul Krugman of the New York Times, the Nobel Prize winning economist. I mean, why do I need to make a comment? Why do I need to justify my comments if I have all these accolades to my name, you know? That's kind of what it seems to me to be like. So I don't get any, I have nothing else really to say about that. Now, what I did think, when I said I did a lot of research into this, what I really wanted to do was to almost to prove to you, ladies and gentlemen, that this is nonsense, that this is absolute pernicious rubbish, what he's saying. And for that purpose, I came across an update of the 6th of April 2009 column by Barry Eichengreen and Kevin O'Rourke, comparing today's global crisis to the Great Depression. Now, I've done this before, and I've told you to beware of comparisons of these different epochs, but nevertheless, this is something of a comparison, and you'll see where I'm coming from as I progress here. World industrial production, trade, and stock markets are diving faster now than during 1929-30. Fortunately, the policy response to date is much better. The update shows that trade and stock markets have shown some improvement without reversing the overall conclusion. Today's crisis is at least as bad as the Great Depression. And the new findings are: world industrial production continuing to track closely the 1930s fall with no clear signs of green shoots. World stock markets have rebounded a bit since March, and world trade has stabilized. But these are still following paths far below the ones they followed in the Great Depression. The big four European Union nations divide north-south. Today's German and British industrial output are closely tracking their rate of fall in the 1930s, while Italy and France are doing much worse. The North Americans, that's to say the US and Canada, continue to see their industrial output fall approximately in line with what happened in the 1929 crisis, with no clear signs of a turnaround. Japan's industrial output in February was 25 percentage points lower than at the equivalent stage in the Great Depression, notwithstanding a sharp rebound in March. The parallels between the Great Depression of the 1930s and the current so-called Great Recession have been widely remarked on. Paul Krugman has compared the fall in U.S. industrial production from its mid-29 and late 2007 peaks, showing that it has been milder this time. And I have noticed this, ladies and gentlemen, with Krugman. He consistently underplays the severity of this crisis. You know, he goes on TV, he has this very low-key approach, he kind of mumbles, but he holds himself out as this great kind of intellectual firehouse of thoughts and profound opinion. And it doesn't work, not with me at any rate. I need more meat on the bones than he's prepared to give. He refers to the current situation with characteristic black humor as only half a Great Depression. Okay. As a matter of fact, if you compare the Dow in 29 to 30 and the S&P 500 in 2008 to 9, which had similarly wide circulation, it shows the stock market since late 2007 falling exactly as fast, almost exactly the same speed and momentum as in 1929 and 1930. When contrasting the two episodes, comparing America then and now, gives you, in fact, a misleading picture, because the Great Depression was a global phenomenon. Even if it did originate in some sense in the U.S., it was transmitted internationally by trade flows, capital flows, and commodity prices. Now, that said, different countries were affected differently. The U.S. is not representative of their experience. This current recession or depression, whatever you want to call it, is every bit as global. Earlier hopes for decoupling in Asia and Europe notwithstanding, increasingly there is awareness that events have taken an even uglier turn outside the U.S., with even larger falls in manufacturing production, exports, and equity prices. In fact, when we look globally, the decline in industrial production in the last 9 months has been at least as severe as in the 9 months following the 1929 peak. The current global picture provides a very different and indeed more disturbing perspective than the U.S. case considered by Krugman, which, as I mentioned earlier, shows a smaller decline in manufacturing production now than then. And similarly, while the fall in the U.S. stock market has tracked 1929, the global stock markets are falling even faster now than in the Great Depression. Again, this is contrary to the impression left by those who are basing their comparison on the U.S. market alone and suggesting that the current crash is no more serious than that of 1929 and 1930. Now, another area where we are surpassing our forebears is in destroying trade. World trade is falling much faster now than in 1929-1930. This has to be seen as highly alarming, given the prominence attached in the historical literature to trade destruction as a factor compounding the Great Depression. So you see, globally, we are tracking or doing even worse than the Great Depression, whether the metric is industrial production, exports, or equity valuations. Focusing on the U.S., like Krugman does, causes one to minimize this alarming fact. This half-Great Recession label may turn out to be too optimistic. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a depression-sized event. Now, having said that, we are only 1 year into the current crisis, whereas after 1929, the world economy continued to shrink for 3 successive years. So what matters now is that policymakers arrest the decline. So let's look at the policy response. In both crises, there was a lag of 5 or 6 months before discount rates responded to the passing of the peak. Although in the present crisis, rates have been cut more rapidly and from a lower level. Money supply for a GDP-weighted average of 19 countries accounted for more than half of world GDP in 2004. Clearly, monetary expansion was more rapid in the run-up to the 2008 crisis than during 1925 to 29, which is a reminder that the stage-setting events were not the same in the two cases. Moreover, the global money supply continued to grow rapidly in 2008, unlike in 1929, when it leveled off and then underwent a catastrophic decline. Now, you have an analogous picture for fiscal policy, in this case, for 24 countries. The interwar measure is the fiscal surplus as a percentage of GDP. The current data include the IMF's World Economic Outlook update forecasts for 2009 and 10. Fiscal deficits expanded after 1929, but only modestly. Clearly, willingness to run deficits today is orders of magnitude greater. So, ladies and gentlemen, the world is currently undergoing an economic shock every bit as big as the Great Depression shock of the 1929-30 period. Looking just at the U.S. leads one to overlook how alarming the current situation is, even in comparison with 1929 to 1930. Paul Krugman, your comments, please. All right. Okay, I'm just writing a message to Alex, our substitute engineer here, because Ryan has left and I needed to get a message to him. All right, let us now proceed to the next piece of joy that I have for you. Here's a question I thought I'd like to deal with. It's from, is there an anonymous designation? No, there isn't. From Ralph M. And it is entitled Cost of Foreclosure. Richard, quick question. You mentioned on the last show that it costs $55,000 for the bank to foreclose on the property. This seems extremely high costs. It seems almost unbelievable. Do you know why it costs that much? I just called a local attorney specializing in tax lien foreclosure, which is a little different than bank foreclosure, and the costs are about $3,000 with all the legal fees. Well, Ralph, banks are fighting an issue we all have to fight, you know. They're doing a good deed, and it takes a great deal more work. And, to save the bank and the lenders money, there are difficult hurdles that need to be cleared. You know, finding out who has packaged the loan, negotiating with them and the homeowner, determining if it will save the bank money in the long term, or why the bank employee is absolutely overwhelmed with work, as they're seeing more foreclosures than ever before. So if you have a mortgage held by a local bank and you're facing foreclosure, you have a much better chance of getting a sympathetic ear to discuss a renegotiation with. If you have a loan that has been sold a couple of times and securitized, then the chances of working out a deal is much more difficult. A report by the Joint Economic Committee of Congress estimates that the average cost of a foreclosure to the homeowner, lender, local government, and neighbors, whose homes decline in value, is $78,000. By contrast, preventing the foreclosure would cost an average of about $3,300 per home. Now, here's how the report breaks out as stakeholders. Homeowner, $7,200. Lender, $50,000. Local government, $19,227. Impact on neighbor's home value, $1,508. Estimated total cost of foreclosure, $77,935. Now, as far as the homeowner is concerned, these costs might not even include everything. It might be more. The homeowner had the cost of moving in and moving out. Some disruption to normal working hours and pay, if they still have a job, and the loss of equity might be far greater. If you only lost 2% of a $400,000 home, you'd still have lost $8,000. The lender is going to have to find a qualified buyer in a tough market, and the creditworthiness is going to have to be better than the first time around with less generous terms. They will have some cleanup costs after the homeowner moves out, which could easily run $5,000 for paint, some carpeting, examination by an inspection service of repair and any minor things they find. Then they have to cover the cost of not being paid any mortgage money. If it takes 90 days to find a buyer and there is a quick escrow period of 30 days, they have to cover for 4 months. Figure a rate of 5%, and the cost is about $2,150 per month for 4 months, $8,600. they will have to pay at least a 4% commission, which adds another $16,000 on a $400,000 home. They have insurance costs, legal costs, processing fees, appraisal fees, and they even have to pay a gardener and service people to maintain the property while it's on the books. And there is one fee that most people would never think of, but assures that the lender wants to get the property off their books. They have to keep cash reserves in the bank as a percentage of deposits and assets. This means a $400,000 asset on their books is going to reduce the amount of money they can lend, even if they have the money to lend, until they dump the property. All this assumes they sell the house for the $400,000, but they may not. If the house has gone down 10% or $40,000, quite likely in many parts of the country, now they are really taking a bath. All right, Ralph, I hope that answers your question. So let's move on. We might as well be devils and take Steve's rent. We've only got 15 minutes to go, and we have an email from Mark. Huh. Oh, Mark, you're on the phone. I'm so sorry. Yes, you are indeed. Mark, hi, how are you? I do apologize.
That's okay.
My computer's badly placed today, it's my fault. Mark, go ahead.
Hi, Richard, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I do apologize about keeping you waiting so long.
Oh, that's okay, that's okay. I was wondering, with the bear market rally, the sucker's rally about to end, would the double inverse mutual funds be a safer bet than they are normally? I remember you were telling us how if the market drops by 1%, then returns to zero by rising by 1%, that the double inverse fund actually loses more money. It doesn't go back to zero.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mark, and you're absolutely right. I am absolutely and totally persuaded that we are at or about the end of this bear market rally, and therefore the purchase of the double inverse mutual funds would be an excellent choice, because any volatility that you're going to see in the near term will be on the upside for the funds and not on the downside, because you're at an extended point in the cycle. In other words, the market is now extended on the upside and should, all things being equal, really trend down from here in the near future. Therefore, you are completely correct. The dangers that one would normally associate with these funds, let's say halfway through the down or up cycle,
mm-hmm.
should be minimized quite dramatically as you begin a new cycle from an extended point. So yes, that would be true.
And then you'd want to quickly leave it after a lot sooner, though.
Not necessarily. You don't want to deprive yourself of a really good profit potential on these things. You really have to play it by ear.
Okay.
You know, it's not what we've seen so far at the top of the market has been an unwillingness on the part of investors to accept that we have really seen the top of this, you know, 5-year bull market from 2003. And so as they come to accept that, the volatility will fall along with the markets. And so all things being equal, the market should fall fairly regularly without these massive kind of influxes of investor interest on the upside. So that should keep your fund on the straight and narrow. So I'm thinking aloud here that you really have to play it by ear, Mark.
Well, but would you wait at least until it crosses the 200-day exponential moving average?
Not necessarily, no. I don't. You've got to make a decision based on what you think the trend is going to be. You cannot fine-tune these things to the nth degree. You can't, or you will never get the
right
exact
point.
Top, and you'll never get the exact bottom.
Okay.
You can use the 200-day moving average as a guide, which I have done,
mm-hmm.
And we have met the 200-day moving average, but at that point, you have to allow the thing to play itself out on its own. So I think at this point, the 200-day moving average becomes irrelevant to a choice of entry on the downside, Mark.
Okay, thank you very much for your help, Richard.
It's been a pleasure, and I do apologize for keeping you waiting so long.
Have a nice flight down to Singapore.
Singapore?
Yeah, have a nice flight.
Where, to Singapore?
Yes.
Yes, I will. Thank you very much. I was thinking about you all the way, Mark. Thank you very much for your, for your best, for your wishes.
Thank you.
All right. So, now we have, let me see, I believe that we have an email from Joni. Hello, Joni. Joni says, hi, Richard. Just wondering your thoughts again. Mortgage interest rates are rising a bit. What do you account for this? Oh, Joni, I just mentioned that a little bit earlier on. I don't know whether you heard me. I was talking about the rise in interest rates and to the 10-year rate, and I mentioned that the mortgage rate was attached to the 10-year rate, and that's why the mortgage rates were going up, not because of any other reason than basic liquidation of bonds on the part of investors. So to continue your email, could they possibly keep raising rates? Yes, they could. And if they do, not to worry. It'll just throttle the economy even more, make it harder to borrow money, make it harder to get a mortgage, which, it, as I said also earlier on, Joni, perhaps you weren't listening at that point, has been the rates, the mortgage market is entirely frozen by the banks, which absolutely don't want to lend money, and they're looking at any excuse to decay the mortgage applications, for which now you have to pay $500 per application, and the chances are very high that you will lose the mortgage and lose the non-refundable mortgage application fee. It's a disaster. Very, very bad. Do you feel the same way? I have heard you say, I continue with Joni's email, do not buy real estate. But what if they continue to raise rates? Is it better to buy now at these rates or buy later when home prices are down but at a higher rate? I guess in the long run, it's difficult to time things. But when it comes to investing so much money, you want to try to keep your losses at a minimum. Sincerely, Joni. Joni, as I mentioned, the rates are going up only because of the temporary liquidation of bonds. And they will come crashing down again. I assure you that interest rates going up are a temporary phenomenon. They may go higher, but do not panic into a mortgage, because mortgages will become much easier later on down the line and at much, much lower interest rates. And, of course, house prices will be much lower along with the mortgage rates. So not to worry. Everything will be fine, Joni. Okay, now we come to Steve's rant, which doesn't last very long, but here we are. The subject is PAYGO. Oh, Joni just says, yes, I just came in at 2:30, I apologize. Oh, well, you see, at least I'm doing my job in your absence while you're sleeping, Joni. What can I tell you? Thank you very much, anyway, for admitting what was actually a good thing, because had you been listening to the show and not heard what I had said, then I would have to question what you were doing while listening to the show, Joni. Anyway, here we come with Steve's rant. Subject, PAYGO. Richard, have you had a look at the latest cross Congress will be asking we the people to carry? It's called PAYGO. It sounds harmless. PAYGO is something 325 million Americans do every day. Pay as you go. We pay with money that we earn. The government, I am sad to say, has no legitimate source of income other than the money they take from you and I in the form of taxes. On the surface, this sounds like a great idea. You would think the government would not be proposing spending on anything that they couldn't afford. Well, you guessed it. That's not the case. Our lawmakers have big plans that include big spending. What a surprise. Congress will not be using PAYGO this year because they would have to tax it at a rate of 100%, and that still would not cover the $5 trillion they flushed down the pooper this year. The fine folks in Congress are hooked on spending, and our taxes will be going up in spite of all the empty promises that are given us. If you have an income at all, then it sucks to be you. This whole PAYGO scam is like an alcoholic saying, I promise to quit drinking as soon as I wolf down my last 10 cases of Jack Daniels. The reasons for a revolution are starting to accumulate. The government can't give us all a state cheese and a handful of food stamps until things are getting better. Richard, you get to see a lot of green shoots when you are sleeping on the grass. Thanks for the wake-up call, Steve Kruger. P.S. I hope you have good entertainment in Singapore, because when you leave America, you will be giving up your ringside seats to the greatest circus in the world, the U.S. Congress. This is a hard act to replace. Think of it, 325 clowns wandering aimlessly inside a huge building, constantly trying to out-stupid the man next to them. It is the greatest show on earth. Man, that is a lot to pass up. What a sacrifice. Oh, Steve, you outdo yourself at each and every turn. I'm proud of you. Thank you very much for that very, very interesting and enlightening piece of... Something's being typed at me by our engineer. I don't know what it is. 5 minutes. Oh, I see. Okay. Well, what can we do for 5 minutes? I've got so much to talk about, I don't know where to start. Well, I suppose we could try to rip through Frank's screed here. He wrote to me yesterday at 10:30 at night. He must have been illuminated and enlightened. Richard, the spin coming from the government and the media obscures people's ability to see clearly. Obfuscation and confusion are the main outputs of both bodies. The following quote gives great advice on how to focus on a simple word and clear your vision. It is from Ilage at TAE. You can talk about the economy till you're blue in the face, make a case for or against a possible recovery, bottoms and top, green shoots, yellow weeds, whatever tickles your fancy and your preferred belief system. And you're sure to find at least a few handfuls of kindred souls and spirits while you're at it. After all, with worsening data continuing to spout from the real economy, the one that pays your salary if you still have one, which pays your mortgage if you still have one, and so on, while the stock market seems to be going up, there is enough confusion to go around for everyone. But in the end, when all the convincing-sounding arguments have been made in the heated discussions that fill hour after hour of street corners, TV screens, worried kitchen tables, bar rooms, and bordellos day after confusing day, it all comes down to one simple four-letter word, debt. If and when you focus on that, and only on that, a lot of the confusion may go away. Not, though, the worries. U.S. households owed 133% of disposable income in the first quarter of 2008, which went to 130% at the end of 2008. If you add the perspective of foreclosures and bankruptcies to that number, that's not much of an improvement at all. The combination of plummeting house values and stock prices cost U.S. citizens close to $13 trillion over the past 2 years, which means their debts are now close to $14 trillion. Credit lines are rapidly vanishing. Credit card spending them alone will be shrunk by $2.5 trillion between now and early 2010. If you realize how many people simply have no funds left to draw on, the only conclusion is that those who do still have room to spend, spend a lot. A lot of credit, that is, not money. Mind you, that is the overall picture of the economy, not a description of individual peoples or communities. There are plenty of people left who can buy what they wish. That's not the problem. The problem is the fast increasing numbers of those who can't. That is what a statistic like U.S. households owe 130% of disposable income depicts, a broader picture of Main Street. And if people start spending less and borrowing less, both of which are inevitable outcomes of the present situation, the U.S. GDP will drop right along with them. Consumer spending still hovers around 70% of GDP, though it's getting a little smaller. Still, U.S. exports are dropping too, so they won't be able to make up much difference. Hence, GDP will fall. So will tax revenues for all levels of government. The result will be rising taxes, but that is a backfire move. Raising taxes on people who get poorer is a silly short-term way to go. In other words, one that is sure to be chosen by many governments. Talking about governments, the U.S. administration has but one answer to the debt that won't stop increasing. The federal deficit is set to rise to almost unspeakable dimensions. The public rationale behind that is as if money moves, the economy will heal itself. There are several reasons why that is a dead idea. First, most of what is spent disappears in previously incurred Wall Street gambling debts and never reaches the real economy, the one the GDP is 70% dependent on. Secondly, hardly a penny serves as build activities that can be relied upon to produce anything of value. Give a man a fish, he'll eat. Give him a rod, and he'll eat for the rest of his life. That idea. We're stuck on the wrong side of it. Real estate values will keep coming down for years to come. There is no credit left to support present asking prices. There is the government, Fannie and Freddie, that cabal, but they don't add value, they add debt. Fannie and Freddie should be flushed down the toilet, but they won't be. Having you pay for your neighbor's home is just too attractive for both bankers and the government. Foreclosures will keep on happening, and they'll do so increasingly for a long time. There are untold millions of homeowners, so-called, who either now or at some point in the next few years won't be able to afford their mortgages. Unemployment will keep rising. The American economy is replete in jobs that don't add anything that has any value. A boom economy can carry the burden of those jobs. A bust economy must shed them or perish. We are, depending on your view, something like 1 or 2 years into the crisis. The one thing that underpins it, debt, has not been addressed at all. On the contrary, the government adds more of it every day, lots more. We are on a road to nowhere, and all we seem to have in the way of response is a denial. That does not bode well. We're not very good in dealing with four-letter words, are we? In our defense, even if we would face up to what our debt burden means, life would look a lot darker than it does in our hope and faith-induced version. Then again, it would allow us to finally start doing something about it. Even after all the lies and sleight-of-hand deceptions, the truth, like debt, will not be denied its day of reckoning. From the foxhole, Frank. And from me, have a great weekend. See you on Monday. Bye-bye.